Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, we have an exclusive conversation with Congressman Dan Crenshaw. We talk about China. We talk about his new book and some of the lessons of philosophy and culture within it. We also talk about the very big $2 trillion stimulus bill, the biggest bill in American history. You guys are not going to want to miss this conversation. But before we get started, please type in the Charlie Kirk Show to your podcast provider and hit subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, you can follow it. If everyone did that right now, we would be surging in the charts and we could beat Joe Biden's podcast. And we were beating Joe Biden's podcast for a couple days. We want to get back up there. Everyone, please enjoy this conversation with Congressman Dan Crenshaw.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Hey, everybody. This is Charlie Kirk, Charlie Kirk Show. We are honored today to have Congressman Dan Crenshaw join the Charlie Kirk Show from quarantine. Both of us are social distancing, but Congressman Crenshaw has been on the Charlie Kirk Show before, and he has a new book out, Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. It is doing quite well. It is ranked very high on Amazon, and for all of you that help support my book push a couple weeks ago, please go buy Congressman Crenshaw's book. It is out this week, and I am very interested in some. I'm actually really impressed with a lot of these chapter titles. But Congressman, thanks for joining the Charlie Kirk Show again. Tell us a little about the book, why you wrote it, and some of the big takeaways for our listeners here.
Yeah, you know, the original intent of this book was to solve the problem of outrage culture. There's been plenty written about outrage culture. You yourself have, of course, written about it, and many other authors. I dissect the problem in this book, but ultimately the purpose of the book is to provide solutions to it. Because the fundamental problem with outrage culture is a lack of mental resilience, a lack of ability to see past your emotions, to overcome, to see yourself as a victor instead of a victim. And I wanted to give really practical solutions, and each chapter is a practical solution and a lesson in mental toughness. And those lessons are derived from SEAL training, from combat, from U.S. history, from philosophy, from the Bible, from psychological literature. So I had a lot of fun writing this. It kind of brought out my inner nerd in some ways, but also some great storytelling. There's a lot of pop culture references in it. I mean, I think people will really enjoy it, and you really will get something out of it. It's actually kind of light on the politics. I mean, it's in there. You know, conservatives will certainly find something to love in there. And but I want it to be readable to more liberal-minded people as well, and I think it is.
Well, so one of the chapters is called The Right Sense of Shame. I think I know what you mean by this, but can you elaborate a little bit on what Chapter 6 is about?
Yeah, I mean a lot of things by the right sense of shame. So on a real micro level, I mean really simply feel bad about stuff. Don't push down the feelings of shame when you do something wrong. I read this news story from a local paper here a local news station here in Houston. And the title went like this: stop leaving your latex gloves on the floor of the grocery store. People have to pick that up. And so that's exactly what I'm talking about. If you're that person, and especially in times like this, who's not doing their simplest duties to keep the rest of us safe and to not litter, well, then you should feel a sense of shame for it. I'm not saying we're all perfect. I certainly screw up all the time. We are all sinners. But the whole point, and this gets into the religious aspects of the book too, which is the whole point of Judeo-Christian values, well, not the whole point, but a part of it is to feel bad about your wrongdoing, and to repent for those wrongdoings, and to aspire to be something better, aspire to be more like our Creator, and to live up to that. So on a micro level, that's what the chapter on shame is about. On a cultural level, I analyze how we have started to contort our sense of shame. And I actually have some graphs in there that are kind of like, I had really a lot of fun creating these things, because I wanted to demonstrate visually for people what is actually happening. And what's actually happening is our leadership, our public figures, they either do one of two things. They show no shame at all, no apologies whatsoever. So think of like Ralph Northam, never apologized, never even cared that what he
did. Good example.
Horrible picture in the yearbook. And I use conservative examples too. And that's one extreme. Just no shame whatsoever. We don't care what you think. Another example I use is Queen Cersei from Game of Thrones. When she is walking naked along the street, she feels no shame for the torment that she's put upon these people. She doesn't care. She's walking in this kind of shameful aspect in this when they're throwing things at her. But she doesn't actually care. And that's one extreme example. And the other extreme is when public figures apologize profusely and unnecessarily. The example I use in the book is Mario Lopez. It was such an interesting example when he was just off the cuff talking in an interview and said, you know, I don't think a three-year-old should choose their own gender. I really don't think they should do that. And he got skewered for it, right? The outrage mob was all over him. And what did he do in response? He apologized profusely, said, I can't imagine the pain that I caused people. I don't know why I did that. He didn't have to apologize. He said a perfectly reasonable thing. And what I point out is we have to figure out what the middle looks like. You know, and we have to give each other the space to live in that middle ground and reverse those bell curves. I don't want to try and explain the bell curves over a podcast. You're just going to have to read the book to understand what I'm saying. But I visualize it for you in the book. And we need to get to a point where we're actually making a little bit more sense. And so I use some good examples too. I loved the Ellen DeGeneres moment when she was at a football game with George W. Bush, and the outrage mob pounced, right? They hated it. They couldn't stand that she would hang out with this conservative president. And she didn't bow down to the outrage mob, but she also didn't ignore it. She said, hey, I have friends, and I can have friends, and I can have friends that I disagree with. And maybe we should all give each other a little bit more grace. And so on a cultural level, that's what the right sense of shame is.
That's very thought-provoking, and I'm pleased that someone who's serving in Congress didn't just write the typical political book, and I'm sure you know what I mean by that, which is, here's my life story, here are the three, you know, big things I think we should do in tax policy in this. I'm sure that's in there, I'm not doubting that, but it's actually, I'm pleased and to hear that there's a book written by a congressman and a Navy SEAL such as yourself that dives into some of these ideas. What do companies like Ring, Hint, and Tecovas all have in common? They all use NetSuite to accelerate their growth. Successful companies know that in order to grow faster, you must have the right tools. If you want to take your company from 2 million to 10 million or 10 million to hundreds of millions in revenue, NetSuite by Oracle gives you the tools to turbocharge your growth. With NetSuite, you get a full picture of your business. I'm telling you, they do a great job here, and you guys got to check it out. Seriously. Whether or not it's business, finance, inventory, HR, customers, and more, it's everything you need to grow all in one place. Run your entire business from anywhere. Even if you're working from home, with NetSuite, you're covered. With NetSuite, we will give you the visibility and control you need to make the right decisions and grow with confidence. That's why NetSuite customers grow faster than the S&P 500. NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system, trusted by more than 20,000 companies. It's amazing. It's the last system you'll ever need. I've used it before, and you guys got to check it out. NetSuite, business grows here. Schedule your free product tour right now and receive your free guide, 6 ways to run a more profitable business at netsuite.com/Kirk. That's netsuite.com/Kirk, netsuite.com/Kirk. I want to ask about one other chapter, and then I want to get into current events. Chapter 9 is something I talk about a lot, and I'd love to get you to elaborate a little bit. And again, the book title for everyone that might want to get it, I want to make sure I get this right, Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. Can you talk a little bit about Chapter 9? I talk about a lot that we are sometimes nothing more than the stories that we tell ourselves, that we can be either our greatest champion or greatest nemesis based on the narratives that we believe in. What do you get into in Chapter 9 when you say the stories we tell ourselves? I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
So a lot of the book is about how to overcome something and not be the victim that you might think you are. And this chapter really wraps it up because sometimes there is real hardship that we face. And sometimes you are truly a victim. I think most of the time our culture elevates victimhood too much, but that doesn't deny the fact that there are people who are suffering and have gone through something difficult. But that doesn't mean that's where your story ends. Your story actually begins right there. The story you tell yourself after that moment is what's actually important. You have to empower yourself. And now the left would often say that when we conservatives talk about personal responsibility and accountability and empowerment, that we're being heartless, that we're not being compassionate enough. I would disagree with that on a very fundamental level. It's actually the most compassionate thing we can do, to tell people that they actually are in control of their destiny, and they have the power to tell a story of being a victor and not a victim. And here's another way to put it, and I think I've said this at some Turning Point events, which is, let's think about it this way. If you love your kids, what do you teach them? Well, you teach them about rules. You teach them that there's boundaries to their behavior. You teach them about consequences. And you fundamentally teach them that if they work hard, that they're in control of their destiny. They're in control of how much they succeed. That's what you teach your kids when you love them. We have to ask ourselves, why wouldn't we teach the American people that? You know, why would we teach the American people the opposite thing? Why would that be our message? Wouldn't we want to treat them like we love them? And if you like that chapter, I think you'll like the chapter 10 the most, because it really gets into not just the story that we tell ourselves, but the story we tell about America. But you'll have to buy the book to read that chapter. It's definitely one of my favorites.
Absolutely. Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. You get into some very important topics here. Some of the other chapters, and we don't have the time to dive into all of it. Chapter 3 is No Plan B. Chapter 4, Be Still. I heard you talking about that on Dana Perina's show. Chapter 5, Sweat the Small Stuff. And then 6, Right Sense of Shame, we talked about. Chapter 7, A Sense of Duty. Chapter 8, I talk about a lot. And again, I'd love to read about your take. So I don't want to go over the whole book because I want people to have a reason to buy it. But Do Something Hard is Chapter 8. Chapter 9, Story We Tell Ourselves. And Chapter 10, The Story of America. And I want to pause on Chapter 10 to kind of get into current events, because I've been a little outraged, to be honest with you, Congressman, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this. I did a whole podcast on it, and I saw some of your tweets about it, which I think were in harmony with some of the criticism I had towards this $2 trillion stimulus bill, $350 million to migrant resettlement, $75 million to NPR and PBS. The unemployment provisions actually incentivize people to stay on the unemployment rolls. The biggest bill in American history. You weren't even actually given an opportunity to vote on it. It was on voice vote only, based on what I understand. And the Senate passed it 96-0. What do you have to say to young conservatives listening to this podcast who quite honestly felt a little bit let down, would be a very nice way to put it, but they said, why on earth are we furthering burdening our generation with debt? Why are we going along with a lot of these leftists' pet projects? Why all of a sudden is it 96-0 in the U.S. Senate? House doesn't get a voice vote. What's your message to young conservatives out there, Congressman, that felt betrayed by some but let down by almost all, that this bill passed through as quickly with very little deliberation around it?
In keeping with the theme of my book, nuance is extremely important here. Anytime you engage in a subject with a great degree of nuance and complexity, you will be less outraged about it. And so on each of those things, you definitely have good points, but we have to tackle them one at a time, I think, to explain them. I'm not going to defend things like the millions of dollars for NPR or the Kennedy Center, especially after they let people go.
Sure.
And people lost their jobs. That was the most infuriating thing. At first, the logic seems sound, because the entire goal of this is to save jobs. Places like the Kennedy Center make their money from events. They can't have events, so they had to let people off. But then they did it anyway, which was, there's no excuse for that, and so I'm not going to try and defend it. I'll defend my own vote. And in a sense, I did vote, because I was there speaking on the floor. We did have a quorum there to vote, should it have come to that. I kind of wish we had, because both parties did a lot of work to get every member there. So we might as well have voted. And I would have voted for it because it was an emergency. And I never like everything in a bill. It's so rare that I like everything in a bill. And that's the problem with it's not a problem. It's a feature, and it just is the way it is, but it's something us politicians have to deal with. I almost never like everything in the bill. On the unemployment question, that's a valid concern. It's valid in some states, not others. It depends on how the state runs its unemployment insurance. But the problem there that you outlined is that in some cases, in some states with some incomes, it might be more profitable to be unemployed than it would be to remain employed. Now, people need to understand, you can't just quit and get unemployment insurance. You have to be fired. So that's the first thing. The question of moral hazard is a valid question. We don't know how that will actually play out. Again, if you know, we have a free society, and the way that society is kept together and kept whole is that we live as good citizens. And so, which is why conservatism as a cultural value is so important. It's why I write about this in my book, Live with a Sense of Duty. You should feel ashamed if you decide that it's better to take unemployment than it is to work. You should feel a sense of shame for that, and you should feel a duty to work and contribute. Conservatism is important because it's a hell of a lot more than just a market theory. We've talked about this. This is why I'm not a libertarian. I'm a conservative, because conservatism captures economics, culture, and politics. That's the Russell Kirk version of conservatism. It's so important. Okay, I won't go down the philosophy route. You have to read my book for that. But let's continue on this policy discussion. So yes, there's a problem with the unemployment benefits. I don't think it'll be as big of a problem as people think it will be. The problem I had, which you didn't mention, was, and I know you have a problem with this, is the direct cash payments.
Oh, I mean, I how much time you got, Congressman? No, please continue.
So the direct cash payments were a problem because you're not giving enough money to people who need it, and you're giving too much money to people who don't need it. It's the exact same problem with UBI, with universal basic income. It's stupid. It's a waste of money. And I advocated for, and I talked to many economists about this on my podcast. Hey, by the way, everybody, listen to my podcast too.
You should. Yeah. We're always jousting with each other in the podcast charts. So.
And I talked to some economists about this, and they're like, listen, if the goal is to help people who need it, do it through mechanisms that already exist, like unemployment insurance. Notice the direct cash payments are late, and they're going to be late because it's hard to do something totally new. Unemployment insurance is already a mechanism that exists, so help people that way. And what we did too is expand who is eligible for it to people like sole proprietors and independent contractors, like Uber drivers, you know, people who wouldn't necessarily be captured under that safety net normally. And that would have been the most efficient way to do it, and then save the rest of that direct cash payment money for, I don't know, how about building supply chains for and investing in supply chains for the materials we need to increase our testing and increase Amen. Our PPE production. I mean, there's a real need to industrialize for some industrial policy right now, and we are doing it. I'd like to see more of it from the federal level, frankly, so that we can open up the economy and have the necessary equipment to do so. That's really important. We can talk about that more.
Sure.
If you like.
Yeah, I would love to. And I just want to kind of close the thought on the bill. I agree with you completely. This is why I'm also not a libertarian as well, because we are we're first a country with an economy within it, not an economy that happens to be in a country. And so the economics is one part of it, but it's also language, it's also culture, it's values, it's philosophy. So I see that just as you do. But when it comes to the small business provision, I think it was written with good intentions. But Congressman, I could tell you, as someone who has gotten into the weeds of this, dealing with the banks and actually seeing the loopholes within it, and I'm not saying that you support the speed to market in the sense where it was not as thoughtfully written as it could have been. However, I'll give you one really kind of insane example. Today, the Small Business Association just issued a new guidance where they said that payroll taxes can be covered by the Small Business Payroll Protection Loan. So think about how silly this is, Congressman. You're going to be taking money from the Small Business Association through banks to pay for your payroll taxes as well, just giving the money straight back to the government, where very well they could have just given a payroll tax, not holiday, but total cut for the employer. So it's basically, the old expression would be borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. But worse than that, the provision in the Small Business Association loan asks for your 2019 average headcount. So any business that has increased their headcount versus the average last year will be able to furlough their employee count down without penalization, as the bill was trying to intend to do. So you're going to have a lot of businesses just furlough down to a certain amount of money, take the SBA loan, which will be totally forgiven. And I know that's not the intention of it at all, but this is obviously what happens when government gets far too involved in that, which we can, you know.
I would say, just based on the many conversations I've had with this, the most likely explanation is that it's administratively easier. It sounds silly at first. It sounds like it's more work, but because our system is already set up in that way, that's actually a lot more work to switch it up. and then it would slow down the loans even more. Again, the second part, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of ways to game this. You know, one thing that worries me is that there's no limit to it, in the sense that a business doesn't have to prove that they're in trouble. And we could have put that limitation on them. We could have said, no, you have to prove that you're actually in financial straits before you apply for this loan. But then what would be the consequences of that? Well, then it would be even harder to get these loans out. I mean, extremely difficult. So, yeah, there's no doubt that in this emergency situation, it's not going to go the way we like. I mean, I'm not even going to defend it. It's,
sure.
I wish it was. I don't like the payroll stuff either as much as you do. Especially when the goal is to keep people on the payroll.
Yeah. And the government shouldn't act as an employee retention program. We should always be focused on production. And I understand the Article 5 argument. Government told you to shut down. Therefore, government, based on Article 5, anytime they take property from someone, they have to pay that somebody an equal or some value of what they take. And you could argue very effectively in court constitutionally, the government is taking people's property away by saying to a restaurant owner, no one's allowed to go in. Health and safety is on the top of everyone's mind right now. No matter what happens, you want to make sure your loved ones are protected. That's why LegalZoom continues to provide a reliable way for everyone to set up the estate plan without leaving your home. I have used LegalZoom, and I just had someone that actually went to LegalZoom, and they said, oh my goodness, my parents don't have a will, my parents don't have an estate plan, and they actually went and used the promo code, and they said it was terrific, it was so easy to use, and the promo code is Charlie, by the way, and it starts with finding the answers to your questions. Do you need a last will and testament or a living trust? What about an advanced healthcare directive? And what's the power of attorney? Thankfully, you don't have to figure out everything on your own. LegalZoom's online resources make it easy to get started. And if you need to speak to an attorney, their independent attorney network is there to guide and advise you. LegalZoom isn't a law firm, so you won't have to worry about expensive billable hours adding up. Take an important step for your family today. Go to LegalZoom.com to get started on a last will, living trust, and more. Start a business, LLC, you name it, LegalZoom has you covered. And make sure you enter the code Charlie, that's right, Charlie, C-H-A-R-L-I-E, the special code Charlie at checkout for special savings. That's LegalZoom.com, code Charlie, LegalZoom, where life meets legal. So I want to kind of finish our discussion here, Congressman, on China. I have been really pleased by your public comments on the Chinese Communist Party. You have signaled support for Senator Josh Hawley's bill to try to have some form of, you could call it repatriation, you could call it reparations. I think that might be an incorrect term. I call it punishment, and well-deserved punishment for the Chinese Communist Party and what they have done to our country, to the West, through this virus and many other actions. We had Senator Rick Scott on the podcast a couple days ago, who called for a total boycott and moratorium of all purchasing of goods from China, a view that I hold. And I have also said that I believe that all visas should be totally suspended until we get back to pre-pandemic employment levels. Congressman, what are your thoughts on some specific policy that you would support in the halls of Congress to thwart China's behavior and the Chinese Communist Party's international ambitions that are proving to be very malevolent?
Yeah, I mean, the real discussion here isn't whether we should do something, it's how we should do it. There's a ton of political will to do something. The question is how we do it and how carefully we think through the consequences of our actions and making sure that it's actually net positive for America. You know, we already know the consequences of just the trade war we've had. There's some good things about that. There's some necessary things, but we can't ignore the fact that American businesses get slaughtered. Our farmers were getting hurt. So there's consequences to everything we do. And I just want to make sure we think through that. There's a lot of ideas out there, such as, hey, you know, we could change the law so that Americans can actually sue the Chinese through our own courts. And you know, of course, the counter argument to that, which I just saw, would be, well, how do you prove anything? You know, and are courts even capable of handling that burden of proof when we can't even get inside China to see what happened? I think we should sanction Chinese officials or not even let them into the UN. If they've been engaged in this kind of misinformation, we should take a broader look. This is really actually a chance. You know, we can do this kind of tit for tat stuff. That's more of a reaction, but let's remember that before all this happened, there was plenty of other policy ideas out there that we just weren't that we just weren't focused on, like the Confucius Institutes,
sure,
intellectual property theft, like China buying ports everywhere. Like, let's use our financial system to actually fund some of these ports around the world. Let's use our financial system to help our exports around the world. Again, this is where I get into fights with libertarians, because they've long been against this kind of stuff. But, you know, I would really recommend, if you're interested in the China thing, I pointed you to one of my old podcasts with Michael Sobolik. He used to work for Cruz, expert on China, really fascinating discussion. He's got so this long list of things that's actually worked. And he pointed out, when I talked about the ports, I was like, okay, well, is that really possible? And he goes, yeah. You know, like last year, the Department of Commerce just went to one of these developing countries, I think it was Burma, and was like, hey, just by the way, if you use our financial system, there's a better interest rate, and we don't have all these restrictions and fine print in here. And they're like, oh, well, we just didn't even know that. We didn't even know we could shop around, because our government and our State Department is asleep at the wheel, and they're not actually out there advocating for American prosperity and American competitiveness. And so this is what Trump brings to the conversation for conservatives. This idea that we should compete as a country, and that there is some kind of nationalistic economic policy that we shouldn't run away from. We have to be smart about it. You know, I have Orrin Cass on your show too. Orrin Cass is really into this industrial policy idea, and it's a really interesting debate on the right. You know, and sometimes I think sometimes I think Orrin Cass goes too far. Like he slammed me for thinking that Uber drivers are a good thing. Well, yeah, I think they're a good thing. I want people to freely own their labor and time. But there's also a conversation to be had about how we make ourselves a little bit more competitive against bad actors like China. And there's a lot we can do.
No doubt. I mean, you and I have discussed foreign policy before, and we'll have more discussions in the future. I come from the perspective that we have a correct view of sanctions on Iran, a mostly correct view of Russia and their ambitions worldwide. I, for one, do not understand why we would sanction Russia and Iran and not sanction China. The counter argument would be, and it is a one done in good faith, that it could harm American business and American entrepreneurs because we're already so interconnected in the supply chain and the trade policies. So, Congressman, we only have a couple minutes remaining. The virus is still, you know, wreaking havoc on people all across the West and all across the country. Where do you stand on this discussion right now of reopening America? And I know that Texas right now is fighting for its life in a lot of different ways. So where do you stand on that? I know a lot of our listeners are very interested in your perspective on that.
So this is the right way to think about this. We're in a tactical retreat right now. Okay, we were shot off the target by the enemy, and we had to retreat and get our wits about us and replenish our ammo and call in some air support. That's basically what it means to do this intense social distancing that we're doing. That's basically what it means to do the shutdowns that we're doing, flatten the curve, slow the spread. What we're failing to do as a country is explain to people exactly why we're doing that. We're doing it so that we can replenish our public health systems. So that's why I said it before. We really need to industrialize and improve our capacity on testing so that we can get back to this new normal rather quickly, where we're going back to work. But, you know, we might take a weekly test, and we might do that for a long time. But guess what? We're also working. So we need to get to this point. We need to set timelines that are actually concrete, instead of saying, okay, we might extend it. Okay, we might extend it. No, we have to be smarter about this and recognize the balance that is needed, and we recognize that we can fight this while we get back to work. But in order to do so, we have to build our capacity a lot more than we're doing now. We've got a few more weeks to do it, and we need to get on top of it.
That's well put. I've called for an Amazon Prime of testing. I would have liked to see $25 million spent on in-home test kits instead of the Kennedy Center's layoff project. So
let me hit that really, really quick. There's some good ones coming out right now. They need to be approved, and then once they are FDA approved, some of these are being made right here in my district. Actually, they're amazing. It's a quick blood test, and you can do it right at home. And then once that's approved, yeah, we need to ramp up the production of that in the billions. I mean, it's got to happen fast. We've got to nationalize around that, or build a national capacity around that.
I agree. Well, Congressman, always a treat to have you on the podcast. The book, again, is Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. It is available this week. And let's make the New York Times have no choice but to put you on the list, Congressman. So I know it's a difficult week to do book promo with all that's going on. So we appreciate you coming on the show and discussing the book and so much more. We'll have to continue this discussion sometime soon.
Yeah, appreciate it, Charlie. Good to see you. Thanks.
Thanks so much for listening, everybody. If you guys want to get involved with Turning Point USA, please go to tpusa.com. We're still starting chapters. We're gearing up for events. If you're able to chip in some money, you can go to tpusa.com/donate. That's tpusa.com/donate. And if you guys want to just continue to get the updates of new shows that we have on the Charlie Kirk Show, we have Glenn Beck coming up, a special Easter episode coming up. You guys can also email us your questions, freedom@charliekirk.com. That's freedom@charliekirk.com. Please subscribe to the Charlie Kirk Show. Type in Charlie Kirk Show and hit subscribe. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Till next time, God bless. From the creators of Cold Case Files and PD Stories come the next great true crime podcast, I Survived. Every week, I Survive presents chilling first-person accounts from people who overcame deadly situations, allowing the survivors to describe the events as they unfolded and how they made it out alive. If you love true crime, you are going to love I Survived. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and many other podcast apps so you can get new episodes every week.